It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The breaking news in the last 20 minutes that we are getting from the Metropolitan Police Scotland Yard, that this crash at the Houses of Parliament of the UK, the seat of government, the very center of power, is being treated as a terrorist attack. Now, central London around Big Ben has been shut down following that crash. The car went into the security barriers that surround that building. Forensic investigators are at the scene. It happened at 7:30 in the morning, a very busy time, obviously, in London. The car, driven very fast, hit first some pedestrians and some bicyclists on the road and then turned against traffic before it slammed there. Armed police, as you can imagine, very fast at the scene. They pulled a man said to be in his late 20s out of the car, arrested him again. This is a quote from the police statement that we just got, on suspicion of terrorist offenses. He seemed calm. He wasn't shouting, wasn't resisting, wasn't apparently armed. But again, a couple of people were said to be injured, none of them seriously. A so-called terror cordon has now been set up around that area, and this is really for the investigation, guys. Again, several eyewitnesses told our sister network Sky News that it really seemed like a deliberate act, but the exact motivation, that's what's being looked at right now. Of course, your viewers will all remember that last March at the Houses of Parliament, there was a vehicle-borne terror attack, and there were four different attacks involving vehicles that were called and defined as terrorism in London just last year. So they're looking hard at this one now, too.
All right, that was Greg Palcott earlier this morning in a report on Fox News. And, of course, we know, and we should be reminded, if we could be reminded without people being killed, that terrorism is alive and well, that Islamic terrorism predominantly has been happening for centuries, as you heard my guest talk about last Friday. And it's pretty much the same. It's killing the infidel. We don't know anything about this 20-year-old, but the police are saying it's terrorism. So probably it's a terrorist attack. Sandy Rios with you on this Tuesday. Now, if I sound strange, there's a reason for it. forgive me just for a second for doing something personal with you, which I seldom do, really. If you've listened to me for a long time, you probably remember that a little more than 2 years ago, last Mother's Day, I had a really bad biking accident in Washington, D.C., and broke my jawbone, my nose, and my two front teeth out, and then a lot of other things. And so it was an interesting event, and the Secret Service came, and I was taken to George Washington Hospital, and they took very good care of me. But in the ensuing months, you know, I realized that it really has impaired my speech. It's not just the teeth missing, but it was also the incisions and repairs on my lower lip that caused numbness. So it was a hit on my ability to speak. You know, I made my living speaking. I used to do commercial work, and people hired me to do reading and all of that. So that's been kind of a slow thing to realize, and it's sad, but I've tried to compensate for that. The reason I sound so strange today is because I finally, in process of getting these teeth permanently replaced with implants, and because I'm in process, I cannot help how I sound in this moment, and it's going to be this way for the next couple of weeks. So I just wanted you to know I probably will not, again, this is probably the last time you'll hear me talk about it this extensively, that's for sure. I will not have my real honest-to-goodness implanted teeth until December, but we'll have something temporary so that I won't sound quite so strange, and I'll be very grateful. I mean, I'll feel like I'm ready for prime time again, where I can actually speak, you know, with having real teeth. It'll be fun. So that's why I sound strange today. We'll be sounding strange the next few weeks. So I guess we can have some fun with it, right? Okay. All right. Today's election day, primary day in several, four different states. And that, you know, that's so important. Have I said before, the 2018 primaries are so crucial. So Connecticut, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Vermont. Connecticut, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Vermont. Those are the four states who have races today, today. And that means you need to find a voter guide. I'd suggest you go to afaaction.net and look at our voter guide. We'll put it on our Facebook page today to make that easy for you. But afaaction.net, it's a great voter guide, by the way. And that will help you figure out where the candidates stand. Let me give you an overview of kind of what's up at stake today. This is a primary, and as I say, this is a Republican and Democratic primary. That means you'll choose the candidate for each party, and then the main election will be in November. But the reason that this is so important is because few people vote in primaries. That means that it doesn't take that many people to actually determine who's going to be the candidate. And generally speaking, conservatives only prevail if they— well, everyone only prevails if they make it to the primary. But this is the chance for really good candidates to win and then become the nominee of their party. So that being the case, let's talk. Al Franken's Senate seat in Minnesota is up for grabs. You may remember that over the Me Too allegations against Al Franken, he stepped down in January. And so this is a an election for someone to hold his seat until his next term is up. So then there is the incumbent, Amy Klobuchar, in Minnesota. She is the Democratic incumbent. She has a challenger. And so they say she's going to be hard to beat, but there is a challenger. There are two former Republican presidential candidates seeking their third terms as governor. That would be Scott Walker in Wisconsin and Tim Pawlenty in Minnesota. You know, the breakdown, it would take me a long time to tell you all the breakdowns here. I just say that in Wisconsin, Scott Walker, of course, has been a champion to conservatives for a number of reasons, but he's in a tough race right now. Wisconsin only went to President Trump by one percentage point, and in the ensuing past couple of years, his popularity has waned in Wisconsin, at least according to the polls. You know, I know one, they have a conservative talk show host there, Charlie Sykes, who I used to listen to sometimes when I was in Chicago. Charlie was just hated Trump, and he had a lot of influence. I'm not saying Charlie's responsible for that, but I'm just saying he certainly did his bit of damage in that arena. And of course, Wisconsin is a state that's really split. It has a long history in communism and the left. And then, of course, there's some great conservative folk, a lot of Christians. And so there's a real divide in Wisconsin and the teachers' unions, you know all about that. How Scott Walker stood against them. So, and then Harley Davidson, the company that's been in the news in the last few days, is located in Milwaukee, and it's been, you know, central to the news in terms of its response to the president's tariffs. And to add this, this is really interesting. The Koch brothers are supporting Scott Walker. The Koch brothers hate President Trump. So, this is a very interesting situation. In Wisconsin, at the very least, there's Scott Walker. Also, so there's a Senate race in Wisconsin. You know, I should let Peter Ducey tell you about that Senate race. Let's listen to clip six.
The field isn't even set yet, but $36.9 million has already been spent on the Senate race in Wisconsin. That's a lot of cheddar.
Folks, this is not a game.
Campaigns for Democrats and Republicans have combined to spend $19 million in Wisconsin, while outside groups have pumped more than $17 million into the race. On the Republican side, businessman and former Marine Kevin Nicholson has a cash advantage over State Senator Leah Vukmir. Nicholson is running as an outsider, and a lot of his donations come from outside the state.
Yes, I do have to be able to raise money, over $3.3 million, over double my primary opponent. And guess what? I don't take offense to the fact that people are donating to my my campaign.
What Vukmir lacks in money, she makes up for in mileage.
I've put on 81,000 miles on my car since I started thinking about running.
She also has the support of a famous local.
She is the person who can best deliver the Senate seat for us.
The winner of tomorrow's GOP primary will face Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin.
She stands with, of all people, Bernie Sanders in calling for a single-payer government-run health care.
Baldwin has a double-digit lead over both Republicans in a recent Marist poll, but she's airing attack ads against both of them anyway.
Tammy Baldwin has worked to make sure our government buys American and hires American. But Leah Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson disagree.
Baldwin was the first Democratic incumbent senator in America to run re-election ads this cycle, and about a third of the $14.8 million her campaign has spent has been on ads, even though she doesn't have an opponent yet.
Tammy Baldwin has spent $5-plus million already, still sits at a 41% approval rating in our state. Anyone who tells you that she's not in a lot of trouble is kidding themselves.
Since President Trump took office, he has made Senate primary endorsements.
I'm just going to say that President hasn't endorsed. So I know that. Tammy Baldwin is a sitting senator who's trying to defend her seat. Tammy was the first openly lesbian senator to serve. So that's always interesting. I remember when she came to power in as a congressman in Wisconsin. It was very controversial then. Of course, now it's like big yawn. But that's the background on Tammy. Senator Baldwin. And so the two challengers, Leah Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson, you heard Peter say, and it's true, Paul Ryan and the establishment is supporting Leah Vukmir. Leah was our guest, you may recall, a few months ago, maybe 6 months ago, we talked about her race. So Paul Ryan is supporting Leah Vukmir, and Kevin Nicholson, described by Peter as the, raising money outside. Well, you can see that the inside of Wisconsin is pretty establishment-centric. We can see that the Koch brothers control a lot of that, that they are, interestingly, Scott Walker is so conservative, I don't quite see how they all reconcile the Koch brothers' positions on things like illegal immigration and other things with supporting Scott Walker, but I guess they know he's a great business. He's really smart when it comes to just doing what's right, so... There's some good stuff about the Koch brothers, but they're certainly not Trump friendly, and a lot of their positions would not be out Christian positions on things. They're pretty libertarian. Kevin Nicholson is supported by Senate Conservatives Fund and other outside conservative groups, and so that's kind of gives you the rundown of what's going on in Milwaukee. But there's another big story coming out of Minnesota. We need to hear that. Let's go to Mike Tobin.
Six-term Democratic congressman, deputy chair of the DNC, and frontrunner for the Democratic nomination for attorney general in Minnesota, Keith Ellison is denying allegations that first went public on Saturday. Austin Monahan, the son of Ellison's former girlfriend, wrote on Facebook that he was using his mother's computer and found over 100 text and Twitter messages that Austin Monahan claims were abusive and threatening. Also a video, almost 2 minutes long, that showed Keith Ellison dragging my mama off the bed by her feet, calling her an expletive, and telling her to get the expletive out of his house. The ex-girlfriend, Karen Monahan, issued a statement detailing abusive behavior and the incident allegedly on video from a day she slept late, and claims the congressman demanded she take out the trash. That is when he tried to drag me off the bed by my legs and feet, screaming, "Expletive, you answer me when I'm talking to you. I said take out the trash." Ellison issued a statement saying he and Karen Monahan had a long-term relationship, which ended in 2016, but strongly denied the abuse. "The video does not exist because I never behaved in this way. Any characterization otherwise is false," he said. Experts say the benefit of the doubt these days goes to the accuser.
Voters, I'm sure, will have a lot of questions about whether these allegations are true and the timing of the allegations, but anything involving sexual assault is going to have a big impact in a Democratic primary.
All right, I'm going to interrupt that report, too. That was Mike Tobin, of course, of Fox. Keith Ellison is running for attorney general in the state of Minnesota. He was the first Muslim congressman to be elected. It was pretty controversial. Remember, he was sworn in on the Quran. And so these accusations are pretty interesting. You know me, I'm not a big one on jumping to conclusions, but I think there is, based on what I'm reading and the way it's worded, it sounds like a credible accusation, that's for sure. And there are videos and texts to sort of back them up. Keith Ellison also was, of course, the head of the DNC. So this could be troubling for all of us. So Connecticut, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Vermont, don't forget to vote today. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
When I first found out I was pregnant, I was surrounded by fear and disbelief. My boyfriend told me at the time to get an abortion. There was no negotiating.
This is the story of a young lady who decided to keep her baby after hearing her baby's beautiful heartbeat on ultrasound. The Ministry of Preborn provides ultrasounds for pregnancy centers across America for free. When an abortion-minded woman hears her baby's heartbeat on ultrasound, she's 80% more likely to keep her baby.
My son Rent turned 5 months this week, and even though there are still uncertainties in my life, the one thing I know is I get to watch him grow.
Your gift of $140 will cover the cost of 5 ultrasounds. All donations are tax deductible. To donate, go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say baby.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. You know, I'm reading through the Old Testament now, and I'm coming to places that are named that I see on our Israel tour every March. It's really fascinating to think that Jericho existed way back in the Old Testament thousands of years ago, and I can visit there today. The same can be said for Jerusalem. The Bible literally comes to life when you visit Israel, the Holy Land. Now, we're going in March. My wife, Allison, and I, we lead these tours every March. So if you would like to go with us, you need to go to the website and check it out. It's twholyland.com. twholyland.com. If you want a brochure sent to your mailbox, just call us at 800-FAMILIES, option 5. That's 800-FAMILIES, option 5, and we'll send you a brochure.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
So my name is Atara. I'm a senior and my major is psychology. I love Truett. Maybe a lot of other schools out there. You can go to bigger schools. You can go to schools that's way far away from home. But in the end, one of the things that I realized is that God called me here, and that's why Truett is the perfect place for me. And if God called you here, then it's the perfect place for you also.
Are you called? Visit Truett.edu today.
The citizens of Southern California have declared war on electric scooters. The scooters have become, for 2018, what the Segway was back in 2001. They go about 15 miles an hour, creating serious safety concerns on the streets and especially the sidewalks. So here's how it works. You scan your driver's license to unlock one of the scooters. Riders are charged by the minute. And once you're done, you just take a picture of where you left the scooter, and that's that. Well, needless to say, folks in places like Beverly Hills are not too happy about that. Piles of discarded scooters in one place stacked 10 feet high. That's why folks around Los Angeles have been taking matters into their own hands. The LA Times reports people have been seen tossing the scooters into the Pacific Ocean. But it turns out the scooters just wash right back up on the shore. Well, maybe they ought to try recycling instead. I'm Todd Starnes.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
White nationalists who came to Washington Sunday on the one-year anniversary of a violent rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, found themselves vastly outnumbered by hundreds of counter-protesters, marching and chanting in the streets around the White House.
Our street! Our street! Our street!
Don't be afraid.
About 20 to 30 of the activists, led by organizer Jason Kessler, rode public transit from Virginia for a march to the White House under heavy police protection. A swarm of counter-protesters jeering them all the way.
You bad bigot! Are you bigot?
Kessler and his small band of followers held their rally behind a police cordon in Lafayette Park across from the White House, surrounded by a sea of opposition. Sunday's events coming in sharp contrast to the chaotic rally Kessler organized last year in Charlottesville that resulted in the death of counter-protester Heather Heyer. As rain swept through the Capitol, Sunday Kessler and his followers ended their rally ahead of schedule and were escorted out of the city in police vans. Counter-protesters continued to fill the streets around the White House into the evening, sometimes confronting each other and the police, but for the most part remaining peaceful.
Really? Okay. That's the Reuters report from the demonstrations. We'll call them that. in Washington, D.C. and Charlottesville, Virginia yesterday. Sandy Rios back with you. I want to challenge Reuters just because that's the first I've heard that report. You know, in the Washington, D.C., there were, I think, 24 Unite the Right protesters. Two dozen, maybe 26, something like that. And there were hundreds of, counter-protesters, really counter-protesters. Counter-protesters, like in black, with masks, wearing black, wielding weapons, attacking the police. But, of course, nonviolent, according to Reuters. I'm going to skip ahead for a second. I cannot bear it to let that stand. Even before I introduce my guests, I want, Adam, if you guys will go ahead and play. The Daily Caller asked some of these counter-protesters what they would do if President Trump showed up. And so these counter-protesters who were, of course, anti-fascist, they're the good guys, of course, against these alt-right, Unite the Right, two dozen people. And this is what they said they would do if President Trump showed up, these nonviolent protesters. Let's listen.
What would you do if Donald Trump showed up at the Trump? Murder him for the people? How about you, man?
Man, I'll tell Trump to get on the on the floor and scrub those toilets himself, because he don't know how to clean. He needs to learn.
He needs to learn how to clean? Scrub some toilets?
Yeah.
I mean, yo, he's America's Caesar, except he's so, you gotta take him down.
If it came down to it and it was a group effort, we'd have to do him like Gaddafi.
Like Gaddafi?
Yeah.
What would you do if Donald Trump showed up?
Yeah, no, I'm a wild out.
You'd wild out?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I'm with him. If I get a tattoo, I would do that.
What's that?
If I get a tattoo, f*** him up, I would.
You would? Yeah. Looks like you got a system right there.
Yeah.
All right. You better stick away.
Blur that out.
Yeah. Hey. How about you? What would you do?
I'd smack him.
Smack him?
Yes. I would smack the out of him, son.
Like that?
Like, for real.
Yeah. All right. How about you, sir?
I'd smack him, too. But it'd be like a pimp slap.
Pimp slap?
Not a pimp slap. With a super...
If the president showed up at this march, what would you do, sir?
If
Trump showed up today, what would you do, sir?
I'd throw a bell at him.
You'd throw a bell at him?
Yeah, why not?
All right. What would you say?
Tell him off.
All right.
If he goes out here, I would tell his wife to go home and for him to get on his jet and get the out of here, too.
Yeah.
And Melania to get out of here, too?
Yeah, because, you know, he hates everybody, but he forgets his wife is an immigrant, too.
I wouldn't say anything, because if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all.
Well, that would be different if Antifa actually didn't say anything. You know, they actually marched in the street carrying a banner that said, it takes a bullet to bash a fash. It's a fascist. And that's what Trump supporters are supposed to be, fascists. These are the counter-protesters, according to Reuters. And if you couldn't hear because of the bleeping, they said they would like to kill him, kill President Trump for the American people. Others said we should do him like Gaddafi, which means, of course, kill him in the streets. So that's the nonviolent protesters, counter-protesters, as Reuters said. What's going on in this country? What's happening? What happened on Sunday? What happened in Charlottesville a year ago? I've asked a good friend of mine who I've not spoken to in such a long time, but he's one of my favorite voices, and we need to fix that. His name is Bishop E.W. Jackson. He's the founder of STAND, which is Stay True to America's National Destiny. He's also a former Senate candidate from the state of Virginia. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School. He was a former Marine, and he is the great-grandson of slaves. E.W., thank you for joining me this morning.
Oh, Sandy, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Hey, before we launch into this heavy stuff, what are you doing right now? Give people an idea of what you're doing.
Well, right now, of course, I just finished up a Senate run. It didn't work out quite the way we expected. So I'm back to running my nonprofit, which is Staying True to America's National Destiny. We've started a project called the Campaign to Awaken the Church because, Sandy, what we're talking about today, to me, this is the result of many years of abdication of responsibility by the church to confront the cultural degeneration that's been going on now for probably 50 or 60 years. And the church has got to rise up. We have got to speak up. We have got to register. We've got to vote. So we started a campaign to awaken the church, and as a subset of that, we're doing something called The Truth in Black and White, where we're confronting this lying narrative that somehow America is a racist, white supremacist country. Sandy, that is such horrible fiction. It is just beyond the pale to describe America that way. Our history is illustrious. We're not perfect, of course, but we're the greatest nation mankind has ever known. We've given more people more opportunity, a higher standard of living than any place else anybody's ever lived on the face of the earth, whether you're black or white or anything else. And for this narrative to be perpetrated by the mainstream media, colleges, Hollywood, Antifa, it's just got to be confronted. So we're going to be doing that in a very intense way, particularly between now and November, as people prepare to go vote in the off-year elections. I mean,
you know what? I'm going to do this backwards from the way I was going to talk to you, and I'm going to start with something you said. I think you and I are probably about the same age, Bishop. And that means that we both grew up in America, I'm guessing now, maybe you're younger than I don't, but the 50s and 60s, I remember
right.
The fire hoses,
yes.
I remember the colored and white bathrooms, I remember colored and white fountains. My sister lived in Atlanta for 12 years, we went constantly, and I remember watching that stuff when I was a kid, and I remember how racial tensions were, I remember racist. I'm having some dental work. My listeners know this, but you don't. So forgive me for trying to articulate here. But I remember the racist members of my not immediate family, because my parents were not, but other members of the family. I had a front row seat to watching the prejudice of the white community toward black Americans. And I know, Bishop, because we've talked before, and you know, I should have you just interject what your experience was like. Let's counter with that.
Well, look, here is the message I am trying to take to Christians, because the mission of STAND is to bring Christians together across racial and cultural lines to defend our Judeo-Christian heritage and values and constitution and so forth. And what I'm saying to people is this. Look, Sandy, what you just described is true. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. But what I tell Christians, remind Christians of, is that race is only a symptom. It is not the problem. The problem is sin. The antidote is Jesus. Mm. And to obsess about race as if it's some sort of unique kind of problem, people have been subjugating, discriminating, hurting each other since time immemorial. And they've done it for a whole variety of reasons. Tribe, geography, religion, ancient feuds between families, you name it. And race is just another one of those excuses that people use to divide against each other. But the answer is the love of God. The answer is Jesus. The answer is not this obsession with race. And the answer is certainly not, Sandy, and this is happening even in some black churches, is certainly not acting like white people are the problem and there's something inherently wrong with them. And you're getting this kind of stuff coming from the Washington Post and the New York Times, and they're saying, you know, there's a problem with white people. I say, well, how is that different than what you experienced, where white people were saying there's a problem with black people? It's the same thing in reverse, and it's not going to get us anywhere but into another cycle of division.
Yeah, I totally agree with everything you just said. Absolutely, I personally watched it, and so I want to continue though with the historical my observations. It's just that I remember all of that terrible stuff. I remember the division, and I remember then the 60s civil rights movement breaking down those barriers, and then I remember my own personal life making and befriending my first black friends in the early 70s, especially one girl, beautiful girl. She and I had such a great bond, and we laughed about our differences and kind of explored each other's hair and all that. It was a breakdown for me. It was my first experience with someone who was black, and it was a wonderful experience, and I think for her too. And but so then I saw race relations began to sort of smooth out, and I saw the black community begin to rise up from inner cities. Not that they all did, but many got out. The middle class grew. Our relationships were better. I actually think, Bishop, and maybe you would agree or not agree, but it seems to me, I was on the radio in the 90s in Chicago doing 3 hours of talk, and I had had a huge black audience, and we talked about race relations all the time. And I actually think that by the 90s, we had come to a place where, sure, we had differences and we saw things differently, but we were actually learning to coexist and kind of enjoy each other. You know, I just enjoy the differences and laugh about them and, you know, still having differences in some opinions. But I think the Barack Obama presidency was the day that Eric Holder said that race was going to be the number one priority of the Obama administration. That, to me, was a turning point, which started stirring up old hatreds and old feelings on both sides in terribly wicked ways. Do you see it that way, or do you see it differently?
Oh, no. Look, I think that Barack Obama, he didn't start this, I think he took to a new level this idea that if you want to control the black vote and you want to keep black people under the control of the Democrat Party, race is the key. And you've got to maintain this victimization mindset. You've got to convince people that race is the problem. You've got to convince them. You know, Eugene Robinson just wrote an article for an op-ed for the Washington Post in which he said, you know, there are exceptions, but we all have to admit that most white people are mean and brutal and hateful. And I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm reading this in what's supposed to be a mainstream newspaper. And I thought the whole point was to not stereotype people, but to treat each other as individuals. So, yeah, Barack Obama comes along and realizes if you want to keep control of the black community and keep them in the Democrat Party, you play the race card. And he did it to the hilt. And you're right. I think in many ways, he set back race relations because
yes.
Some of us hoped, who didn't agree with him on a lot of the other issues, that he would at least bring healing
totally. And
unity across racial and cultural lines and help us see each other as individuals, not as members or representatives of some race. He did exactly the opposite, and it's sad. And I formed the organization Stand in part to offset that, to confront that, to say, no, that's not the right vision for America. The right vision is one nation under God, indivisible with liberty and justice for all.
You know, I don't know if it's just my imagination, but I sense that kind of we came to another tipping point, that we might have come to another tipping point where because we are brothers and sisters, sometimes the audience now, many of us are brothers and sisters in Christ for sure. But I would say broaden it to say conservative blacks and whites are beginning to see the extremes of the Black Lives Matter movement, the extremes of the Antifa movement. Call, for heaven's sake, they call Candace Owens, the young black activist, a racist. They called her a racist and attacked her, all these white Antifa members. I mean, the bizarre nature of these, the irrationality is beginning to be more and more simple to pick up, easy to pick up. And I feel like maybe there's been a turning point again. Do you sense that, or is this just me sitting in the studio imagining this?
You know, Sandy, I love this country. I mean, I served in the United States Marine Corps. I really believe that one of the greatest blessings any individual could ever have is to be born in America, to be a citizen of this great nation, and to enjoy the opportunities that it affords us. And I want the best for my country. So I don't say these things lightly. I heard Heather McDonald say it. You know, she's the writer who's written about, you know, police brutality and some of the mythology around that and the use of that in playing the race card. I hear people talking about civil war, Sandy. This is the first time in my adult life I've ever heard reasonable, rational, intelligent people say, you know, it feels like that's where we're headed. So, yeah, I think this whole Marxist, socialist, collectivist mindset that the colleges have perpetrated on our young people, I think it is really coming into its own. It's being represented by groups like Antifa. I mean, notice how many hundreds of them there were, and a few of these white supremacists,
yes,
who I say, you know, are nutcases, and most Americans look at them and kind of yawn and go, what are these dummies doing? I mean, why don't they go do something, you know, with their lives as opposed
exactly
to that? But the other side, the left, I think that's where the real danger is. I think they want a chaotic America.
Yeah. We have to take a break.
I think they want us at each other's throats.
Hold that thought, Bishop. We're going to be back in just a second. Bishop B.W. Jackson is my guest. He is with the founder and president of STAND, STAND. Sandy Rios with you back in 1 second. Don't go away.
Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. No one likes to suffer difficult circumstances. In this era of easy believism, it's often conveyed, if life isn't always smooth, we're doing something wrong. The scripture teaches us, however, that our Lord often meets fruitful branches with additional pruning. The pruning is not punishment. It's actually to make us even more fruitful. If you're in a rough spot right now, take heart. What may feel like the squeeze to end all squeezes could very well be the Lord's pruning for additional fruitfulness. When the Lord prunes us, he does so for our good.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. Winston Churchill accurately described Islam as the, quote, most retrograde force in the world, end quote. More evidence comes from a dilapidated compound in New Mexico where 11 children were found in squalid conditions. Authorities say the man who ran the compound, Siraj ibn Wahaj, was an extremist of the Muslim belief. Evidence is now emerging that he was training the children in the compound to carry out shootings in American schools. Wahaj's grandfather is an imam at an extremist mosque here in America who is an unindicted co-conspirator in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. In Europe, between 2014 and 2017, minors under the age of 18 were involved in 34 terrorist plots. What is clear is that it's no longer just Muslim adults we need to keep an eye on.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
I've been an advocate for biblically responsible investing for many, many years, 30 years, because I'm an advocate for permanent income.
This is Dan Celia from Financial Issues.
I remember having two sisters that had trust funds that I managed. They were family trust. They were the third generation. They were in their 80s. They had more money than you could shake a stick at. They didn't want for anything. And even them, at one point in time, said to me, do we have enough income to pay our bills, our electric bill? That's all they cared about. I'm telling you, you're going to get to that point. So it's not an investment. It's a gift. It's permanent income.
Find out about charitable gift annuities when you call 800-326-4543, extension 345. 800-326-4543, extension 345. Or by visiting afafoundation.net.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Once upon a time, the world was considered a bipolar place in which the United States and the country ruled by the Kremlin were seen as superpowers. Over the decades, these countries forged a series of arms control agreements that were supposed to make the planet safer and more peaceful. There were, however, two problems. First, the Kremlin's rulers, initially doing business as the Soviet Union and then as Russia, violated each of these accords. And second, such bilateral arms control treaties left completely unconstrained the growing threat posed by communist China. Vladimir Putin's most recent cheating on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty, and his preparations to do the same with the so-called New START limitations, fully justify ending our participation in this one-sided and increasingly dangerous fraud. We must rely instead on the time-tested practice of peace through strength. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
no borders, no walls, no USA at all. Those are the counter-protesters, those innocent little people who are just so upset with the racists that they have to come and protest. That's the narrative. Of course, the narrative is nonsense. These innocent little protesters talked, as I played a clip for you earlier, about what would they do if the president showed up. And one said he would kill the president on behalf of the American people. He repeated it twice. The other said we should do him like Gaddafi. In other words, drag him through the streets and kill him in the streets. And others said things I can't repeat. One of the things they chanted also over the weekend was last year they came with torches. This year they come with badges. Why are you in riot gear? We don't see no riot here. Trouble is they did attack the police. They attacked one policeman on a motorcycle, knocked him over. And I saw myself a clip in Washington, D.C. of a group of policemen on motorcycles. There were four, at least, in the frame. And the protesters were jeering them and pressing them. And I was shocked, honestly, that the police backed up. They backed up, and then the protesters came surging. And then they started attacking one policeman, and he turned around and sprayed them with pepper spray, I think. Since when do we live in a country where protesters can attack police without there not being some kind of response? But this is where we are. Our police have been neutered, and they can't respond the way they should to stop this, to stop this. They also carried a banner that said it takes a bullet to bash fash. That's fascist. We are the fascists, by the way. It takes a bullet. This is where they marched down the streets of D.C. saying that. By the way, the Secret Service is now, as best we can tell, exploring what some of these death threats. And so maybe something will happen. I hope so. E.W. Jackson is our guest. He is the founder and president of STAND. Again, a graduate of Harvard Law School and the great-grandson of slaves and a former Marine who loves this country and, above all, a man who really loves God. That's the thing I love the most about Bishop Jackson, among other things. I want to know, Bishop, were you in or around Charlottesville last year? And even if you were not, what was your take on what happened there?
Well, look, I only live about 3 hours from Charlottesville. I'm in and out of Charlottesville a lot. In fact, while I was running, I went and did a major speech on race in Charlottesville to address what had happened last year. Look, I think what happened was that outsiders on both sides, these white supremacists came in. They were unfortunately supported by a few of our misguided citizens who shouldn't be giving them any credence whatsoever. And then, of course, Antifa came in. And the thing I really hate about these white supremacist rallies is that Antifa and the left then uses this to say, see, this is America. This is exactly what America really represents. This is what America is really all about. Like you said, no borders, no wall, no USA at all. America is a bad place that needs to be destroyed. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth, and these people don't represent our country at all. They represent themselves on a fringe element. But nevertheless, they get international news when they create these kinds of confrontations, and that's what happened in Virginia. I think the people of Virginia, for the most part, are much more level-headed than that. And even with regard to the Confederate monuments, I say, you know, if you take them all down, if you leave them all up, it doesn't help one person get a better education. It doesn't help one person get a better job. It doesn't help one public school do a better job at maintaining order within its school. It doesn't make the streets any safer. And basically, all it is a symbol of hatred on the one hand of white supremacists who decided, I guess, they hate whoever they hate. And these Antifa people who hate the country and seem to hate pretty much anybody who loves the country, particularly, of course, white people. So it was a bad situation. I don't really believe, though, that it represented Virginia. I believe it represented a bunch of outside groups who wanted to use the platform to call attention to themselves.
You know, it's just interesting because I remember when that rally was in the works, and I remember reading about Unite the Right. Unite the Right, what's that?
Yeah.
And those of us in D.C. began to say, who is this? I mean, are we? We're sort of the we're on the right. Who are these people? We look at the list.
With them at all, yeah,
we didn't even recognize anyone involved, and then we find out later that Jason Kessler, the organizer, was an Obama supporter and one of the leaders of Occupy Wall Street. That's Jason Kessler. He's the guy that organized the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, and then also the one the year later one over the weekends. And so it's something's going on here that's extremely bizarre. And so the thing that really distressed me too, Bishop, is that you probably know, and I'll pick on Southern Baptist because I believe it was Southern Baptist. They certainly started this letter from Christians led by Russell Moore denouncing the alt-right, after quote-unquote alt-right, which is personified by Richard Spencer, who has nothing to do with the right. If you saw the movie by the recent movie of Dinesh D'Souza, The Death of a Nation, he interviews Richard Spencer, and he asked the question, "Do you believe all men are created equal?" "No," said Richard Spencer. "Do you believe in individual dignity?" "No." "Do you believe in the right to life?" "No." "Where do rights come from?" "Spencer, well, they don't come from God." "Well, where do they come from?" asked Dinesh. "They come from government," he said. So I could go on and on. Richard Spencer, the so-called alt-right, he might be part of the Nazi right, but he's not part of the American right. So there are lies and distortions taking place that are actually having effect on Christian pastors and their leaders.
Well, because unfortunately they are subject to the influence of the mainstream media, and they are on the defensive so much against being dubbed as racist that they end up really missing the mark. Because look, Sandy, you and I both know Jason Kessler, this other guy, these people are not going to have a whole lot of influence on a whole lot of people other than on the fringe. They certainly don't represent conservatism. They certainly don't represent the right as we think of it, mainstream conservative thought. The people that they really ought to be concerned about are people like this woman, Sarah Jong, that the New York yes. Times just put on their editorial board, who has written all kinds of vile, racist tweets against people. I mean, profane accusations against all white people. This guy, Eugene Robinson, like I said, who basically wrote a piece that the Washington Post ran that basically said, you know, there are some decent white people, but we've got to admit those are the exception to the rule. I mean,
do you think he really believes that?
These are people who are seen and heard, by millions, and these are supposed to be mainstream thinkers. They're influencing our young people. They are setting a tone for the future of this country that is, quite frankly, quite frightening.
You know, it does seem to me there's a point at which people become obsessed with an idea, and even if they're, you know, IQ has nothing to do with, and your thinking gets distorted. I think that with people that hate Trump with irrational, they lose their rationality. And then I think of people who obsess on racist things. They'd start seeing everything as racist. I think of maybe a woman abused by her husband who starts seeing all men as abusers. You know what I mean?
Our
thinking becomes distorted. And I think that's what we're dealing with here. You know, there's a reason.
Well, Sandy, let me just say this, because I want everybody to remember this. I say this everywhere I go. It's not the skin, it's the sin. That's the issue, and people need the love of God. They need Jesus, and our country, unfortunately, has been going away from Him. And the further away from Him we get, the worse things get.
Yeah, no question about it. There was a poll that came. Actually, our friend, yours and mine, Star Parker, shared this. That's how I know it. She said that it looks to like 27% or 29%. I'm not sure which. Of African Americans are now supporting President Trump, which really surprised me. So I asked you this a little bit earlier, but I think you said no, actually. I think the inference was no. Are you seeing any sort of... look, I'm not equating lack of racism with supporting President Trump. They're not the same thing. But are you seeing a move by Black Americans to support Trump? That's a separate issue. But are you seeing that yourself?
You know, Sandy, I've been seeing a slow but steady awakening within the black community, because you can't keep selling the same old or singing the same old song when the results simply aren't there to show. And so we've had the Democrats telling everybody for 60 years now, the problem is race, the problem is race. And in the meantime, thousands of young black men die at the hands of black-on-black crime because they're raised in single-parent homes that were engineered by the left, because they gave incentives to get men out of the home. They built these concrete jungles for people to live in. They created subsistence existence in a lot of these ghetto communities. Gangs came in to replace fathers and male mentors. You've just got chaos. And now in Chicago, what, over the last month, a hundred shot, maybe probably more, 25, 30 people killed. It's like a war zone. And you can't keep singing the same old song, say, oh, well, it's racism, it's racism, it's racism. Nothing gets better. And I think people are starting to say, well, now, wait a minute. You know, they ridicule President Trump for saying this when he said, what do you have to lose? In other words, look at what they have done in the places that they've been in control, where it's gotten worse and worse from one generation to another. What do you have to lose by giving me a chance? And wow, wow, has he been producing. And I think you got to be irrational or insane not to say, well, wait a minute, lowest black unemployment ever? The man is trying to reform the criminal justice system to make sure that blacks aren't treated unfairly or incarcerated in an inappropriate way. The man is trying to address the problem of gangs and violence in inner cities like Chicago. Well, you know, maybe I ought to listen to what he's got to say. And I think more and more people, even Kanye West.
Yeah, oh, isn't that something?
Something has been happening for a while. I just remind people, Sandy, that people like me, and not just me, but Alan West and Star Parker and others have been out here for years being ridiculed and persecuted for standing up with conservative ideas that actually solve problems. And I think now we're beginning to see the fruits of our labor, and people like Candace Owens and others are coming along, and they are really, not that they're not great people in and of themselves, but they're really reaping a lot of rewards from all the seed that's been sown for, my goodness, 50 years.
I think so too. That's exciting. And honestly, Bishop, it makes me mad. I get so angry when I see what has happened to race relations. How dare the left divide us in this way and stir up the wounds of the past to create a division where we cannot enjoy each other as fellow Americans with so much more in common than we have that's different. And one other thing I remember one time when I was doing an open line in Chicago, a woman called from the South Side, and it was one of the most moving comments. She said, you know, I look at our young people and our communities, and these are the ones that are experiencing all these killings, and they were then too. And I see no light in their eyes. It's like there's no one there. There's a vacant look. It's like our kids have lost their soul. And, you know, ironically, we're seeing that among white kids now. Maybe it was always there and I just couldn't see it. But now it seems to me the mainstream, like the Antifa kids, the kids even working as clerks in stores, or that you America's children are losing their souls. They're like becoming, their faces are not everyone, I understand, so spare the email. But we really do need Jesus.
When you reduce people to a collectivist mob rather than the sacredness of each individual, this is what you get.
Yeah. The absence of God. She really described it well, didn't she? No soul, because, well, it doesn't mean you don't lose your soul, but you lose your godlike. God created you in his image, and it's just missing. It's vacant. You can't see it, even though it's still there.
Amen.
Well, we could talk about the theology of that for a long time, but Bishop Jackson, it's always a pleasure. How can people get in touch with you?
They can go to standamerica.us, standamerica.us. That's my website. Would love to hear from them. Thank you so much for having me on, Sandy.
My pleasure, Bishop. We'll talk to you again soon. God bless
you
and everything.
God bless you. Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.